Hey, it's Dr. Jamie, and let's talk about the importance of salt and electrolytes. If you're living the low-carb life like me, your requirements are actually much higher. And there's only one source that we trust in our home, and it's the people and products at Redmond Real Salt. They keep us coming back for more every time. Real Salt's an all-natural, unrefined sea salt harvested from an ancient ocean. It's full of natural minerals that make it healthy, delicious, and pink or red-looking. They're also the best-selling brand in America's health and food stores. Redmond Real Salt is so pure, it's free of pollutants and microplastics found in many other natural refined salts. The Redmond Salt Deposit is in Redmond, Utah, where the team enjoys award-winning work conditions and generous pay. And since they own and control the whole process, you can be sure that Real Salt comes to you through their world-class production facilities in its unrefined, mineral-rich, delicious state, exactly as nature intended. Redmond has amazing natural products, including salt, electrolytes, toothpaste, and so much more. So check out the entire line at www.redmond.life, where you can use my code DRFIT, that's D-R-F-I-T, for a discount on all Redmond Real Salt and Relight products. To the Fit and Fabulous podcast with Dr. Jamie Seaman. Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Jamie, and welcome back to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. I am so happy that you are here, and I'm so thankful that you guys have listened to previous episodes. You've left your comments, your reviews, you've downloaded them, you've sent them to all your family, friends, your grandma, because you tell me about it all the time in the episodes that you love. So welcome back, and I have an amazing guest on today's podcast, Dr. Stephen Hussey. You guys, he is a chiropractor and a functional medicine practitioner. He's attained both his doctorate of chiropractic and a master's in human nutrition and functional medicine from the University of Western States in Portland, Oregon. He's a health coach, a speaker, and the author of two books. You guys, they're amazing. One is The Health Evolution, where understanding evolution is the key to vibrant health, and Understanding the Heart, surprising insights into the evolutionary origins of heart disease and why it matters. And we are going to discuss these topics on today's podcast. He helps clients from around the world get back to health by using the latest research and health attaining strategies. In his downtime, he loves being outdoors, playing sports, reading, writing, and traveling. Dr. Stephen Hussey, welcome to the Fit and Fabulous podcast.
Thanks for having me. Super excited to be here.
So tell our listeners a little bit about your story, because I think it's, you know, unique. I love the work that you do. If you guys don't follow Dr. Hussey on Instagram, you got to go do it. He puts out just amazing content. But tell us a little bit about your background and your story and how you ever ended up writing these books in the first place.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, just like many people in this space, you know, I was pushed in this direction by my own health journey. When I was a kid, I had a lot of inflammatory health conditions, I would say. So I had, you know, everything from chronic hives just used to break out all over my body. I had asthma, allergies, IBS, and I also ended up with autoimmune type 1 diabetes. So my body attacked my pancreas or certain parts of my pancreas, and now I don't make insulin anymore. So I'm diabetic. As I grew up, I my parents and I were kind of, you know, reliant on Western medicine to help us manage these conditions. And so that was the key. They were helping us manage them. No one ever told me why they were happening or what I could do in my life to fix them. As I grew up, I learned that the way I lived my life had a direct impact on how I could manage or even reverse a lot of these conditions. And I'm happy to say that all those inflammatory conditions are gone. Aside from the type 1 diabetes, which is kind of collateral damage that happened. And so as a type 1 diabetic, I'm heavily predisposed to heart disease. I spent a lot of time researching heart disease and just health in general, trying to prevent that kind of stuff from happening. Sometimes successful, sometimes not successful. But I came across a lot of information that as you can tell by the names of my books, like evolution was a big thing for me. Once I understood that, I started to get answers, personal answers for me of why we're so sick as a population, but also why I was having these issues. The heart book, I came across a lot of information that was contrary to what, you know, is said about like what the heart is, what causes heart disease. And I started talking about it, you know, on social media, you know, a couple of years ago, or I guess it's been 3 or 4 years ago now, and people seemed to like it. And so I ended up writing these books, and now I'm here.
Incredible. Okay. So how old were you when you got diagnosed with type 1?
I was 9 years old.
Okay. and talk to us just about like the treatment of your diabetes at 9 years old versus today.
Yeah. So, you know, they hospitalized me for a week when I was diagnosed. When I went to the doctor that day, the estimated blood sugar was over 700. And so, yeah, it was just teaching me how to use insulin pretty much. And I remember going to endocrinologists early on, and I had a great pediatric endocrinologist. He was amazing. He didn't quite understand like the things that I understand now, as far as like how to help me manage things lifestyle wise. It was always about give yourself more insulin, give yourself more insulin, that kind of stuff. And so I remember getting a book that had literally every fast food item in every fast food restaurant listed and the carbohydrates that were associated with it, so that I knew how much insulin to give myself. But basically it told me as a kid, it's okay to go to eat fast food. Just give yourself insulin for it, you know, even though I'm giving myself huge amounts of insulin. And so, yeah, you know, I started to realize in college that, you know, once I had to feed myself, that the way I fed myself had a huge impact on my ability to manage and stabilize blood sugars. And I wondered why I never heard that, from a doctor, you know? And so, right. Yeah. And so now, you know, I, from that point on, it was a bunch of trial and error. I tried all kinds of different diets and different health strategies and, you know, how I exercised, when I exercised, all these different things I noticed had these impacts on my blood sugar. And I was never really told this. It was all about give yourself insulin before. And so now, you know, I have a very regimented way of eating. I eat the same, pretty much the same things every week, every day, because I know how much insulin to give for that food. I never get bored of it because I like feeling good, you know? So, that's what I have to do to feel good. I exercise the same amounts each week, the same times, pretty much, use the sauna and do just to have like a sales strategy, because I'm trying to be a pancreas, you know? And so I'm trying to manage these blood sugars. So having that stable, routine, is very, very helpful, because I don't have to try and predict what's going to happen. I can know.
Yeah. Like less variables.
Yeah, definitely.
How, I know a few type 1 diabetics that, you know, eat low carb, and a couple of years ago, a nurse practitioner that actually works, in my office, she transitioned to low carb, and she reduced her insulin usage by like 50%, and which ended up saving her like a significant amount of money. Because we know, you know, I'm sure there's people listening, you know, insulin for some people is extremely expensive, and it's not, they don't get to choose if they get to take it or not. No.
It's yeah, either it's, death it's very or take expensive. It. Yeah. It can yeah, be very expensive, like, depending.
How high, like, maybe at your worst year of control, like how many units of insulin, mm-hmm. like can you give people an idea, like when you actually are under control, like how much of an
impact? Yeah. I can remember in, cause like in high school, I was still like, you know, taking injections. I guess I use injections now, but I had an insulin pump for a long time, for almost 22 years, but I went back to injections cause I felt like it was working better. But, in high school, I can remember, first of all, I can remember in high school, my A1C was 11.2 at one point.
Wow.
But you know, I was a pretty rebellious teenager. I didn't really pay attention or care too much about the future, I guess, but I eventually figured it out. But yeah, I can remember taking like between 30 to 35 units, a day, twice a day. So like 60 units at least. And if I ate more carbohydrate foods, I'd have to take more. I can remember that. And now, you know, I give like my long lasting insulin, I give like 15 units a day. And then my meals are anywhere, depending on what I eat, anywhere. I'd say the most I take for a meal is maybe five, six units, something like that. So it depends, again, it depends on what I eat. Like, and it depends, like the timing depends too, because if I'm on a, like there was times I was on a carnivore diet, and I'm usually on a higher animal foods, higher protein diet. And like, that's not going to hit my bloodstream when carbohydrates would. So I have to kind of, you know, wait an hour or something and give the insulin, or give some when I eat and then some later, you know, and lots of type ones don't understand that. And they go on lower carb or higher animal protein diets. They don't quite understand that. And cause it'll drift up slower if you don't give that second dose, you know? And to be clear, like the reason that all this predisposes me to heart disease is because it's the fluctuation in blood sugars. you know, as far as I'm concerned, or what I've seen, like the research shows that it's not necessarily that higher blood sugar causes too much damage. It's the ups and downs. It's the peaks and valleys, you know, that cause the most damage. That's what damages the lining of the artery, leading to atherosclerosis. And so that's why I'm predisposed. So I try and keep things stable, you know, and bring things up and down. So, which is why protein is so awesome, because even if it does go up, it's going up very gradually rather than carbohydrates going to spike it, you know?
Yeah. And I think you bring up such a good point, because it's something I talk to my patients about. When people have been low carb or ketogenic for a period of time, you can actually develop, you know, lower insulin secretion from the pancreas. You've downregulated those beta cells. You almost have kind of a physiologic insulin resistance. And so then if you have a birthday party on Saturday and you just go off the rails and have some cake and drink a beer and eat some chips and whatever, you can have a crazy hyperglycemic episode. And that is extremely detrimental to the endothelium. And we're going to dive into heart disease here, but I think that's something that people need to hear, is that depending on where you live in carb moderation, you never want the extremes. Like if you're going to add carbs back in, you want to do it gradually. If you're going to, you know, take them out, you want to kind of do it gradually too. So obviously we, you know, that have functioning pancreases don't have to titrate it to the level that you do. So God bless, you know, people like you that have to really think and understand the ramifications of those things. So talk to us about the evolutionary origins of heart disease, because humans at some point in time weren't dying of heart attacks and strokes at the rate that Americans are now.
Yeah. So in the first part of my book, Understanding the Heart, part one is about I take you through the history of life. And there's certain events that I point out in the history of life that I think lead us to this physiology that we have today that has become imbalanced and is creating heart disease today in the modern world. And so the first one is, you know, the mitochondria. So I talk about, you know, when the first multicellular organisms formed and how that eventually became, you know, a cell that engulfed another type of bacteria. Now we have this thing called mitochondria, and why that's so important, especially for, you know, metabolism and proper metabolism, because metabolic health is super important. For heart disease, it's like poor metabolic health is a better indicator of whether or not you're going to have heart disease, better indicator than cholesterol or anything on a lipid panel, except maybe triglycerides. So it's really, really important to understand how that formed, so that we can understand how it breaks down, and why it's so important. And the other aspect of that is that, the heart is one of the most mitochondrial dense tissues in the body, because it's always contracting. But notice I say the word contracting, not pumping. So that's part of it. And then I also talk about the autonomic nervous system, and how it formed and how it had to change from when there was reptiles and when those reptiles evolved into mammals, and how it had to change, because these mammals are very metabolically active, warm-blooded, energetic beings, where these reptiles were kind of slower, cold-blooded, and their metabolism was not as much. And so in order to have a metabolism like that, our nervous system had to change, because we could not have a stress response, being that energetic and that metabolically active without damage to things. Because reptiles can literally play dead. They can shut down organs. And if that happened to a mammal, that would not be good news. So our nervous system had to change, and our response to stress had to change. And then Say what?
I'd like to be able to do that though.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's still, and I describe in my book, there's still a situation where we get imbalanced and it can cause issues, because of the modern world, you know, because of, you know, the way we're living in these, you know, I guess numerous amounts of unnatural stressors, I would say.
It's just go, 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 go.
Yeah. And our higher level thinking, like we're the only species that can think our way into a stress response.
Well, think about our own thoughts, like have thoughts about your own thoughts.
Exactly. And so you can just get into this cycle, and you can think your way into a stress response. And that's not very compatible with our evolved autonomic nervous system, our evolved stress response system, you know? And then I talk about, you know, what literally made us human, or part of what made us human, which was, you know, the eating of animal fat, animal protein. It drove the evolution of modern day humans. And there's even evidence that you know, Neanderthals and modern humans were pretty much carnivores. You know, they pretty much ate almost entirely animal foods at some point in human history. That's what drove that, combined with fire and cooking of that meat, drove the increase in stature, the increase in brain size, the explosion in population, that kind of stuff. So I talk about those things, and I talk about how, if that's what literally made us human, how that couldn't be really the cause of a modern day disease. You know, if we've been eating those foods for millions of years, how could, you know, this modern disease, heart disease, it's only been around for 100 years or so, be caused by that, you know? And I talk about how really at the turn of the century, physicians were almost figuring it out, and they were eating more less processed foods, that came about during the Industrial Revolution. These flours and sugars and things like that, they started eating less. And then I talk about what happened in, the 1950s and 60s when heart disease started to become a thing, and how it got blamed on cholesterol and saturated fat, and how that became the story, and how it stuck until recent times. Like we're starting to see more research that shows that's not the case. But it's research the research in the beginning showed that, but it was just ignored, and the story just went on because there was already a lot of money behind that story and that idea. And so I talk about all that. So the first part of the book is really getting to an understanding of how our physiology formed to predispose us to heart disease in the modern world. And then also how we got to where we are as far as our current thinking about what causes heart disease. Because it's really important to understand that before we can understand the big ideas that I have about the heart in general.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, so it seems like when we talk about heart disease, all patients ask me about cholesterol, and especially in the low carb ketogenic space, because in certain patients we can see increases in LDL or quote unquote bad cholesterol, which it's not even cholesterol, it's a lipoprotein. But talk to us about why cholesterol is not the culprit of heart disease. We're so focused on that right now.
Well, I think that I like to point out a few things. Like, one thing is that, so cholesterol, if it's elevated, let's say it's significantly elevated, let's actually familiar hypercholesterolemia, where your LDL could be like over 500, let's say it's elevated. It's elevated everywhere in the blood. So why do we only see atherosclerosis in certain places? You know, why is it only in places like where there's more turbulent activity or a bend, or where there's more pressure in the arteries, like the coronary arteries are under more pressure? Like if it was causative, then it would be causing atherosclerosis everywhere, widespread throughout the whole arterial system. So why don't we see it in veins? It's literally absent in veins unless we, transplant a vein into the coronary arteries to do a bypass. Then it promptly develops atherosclerosis because there's more pressure now. So just thinking about it that way, it shows that it's not cholesterol that's causing atherosclerosis. So for some reason, cholesterol gets deposited in an artery, but it's not because it's this evil thing that just goes and likes to attack arteries. It's because it's a response of the body, right? So if we think about, cholesterol plays this vital role in the body. It has so many different roles. It's what vitamin D is made of. It's what our sex hormones are made of. It plays a role in cellular communication. It's transporting energy. It's transporting fat soluble vitamins. I mean, there's so many different things. It's like what your brain's made of. And so it doesn't make sense that this molecule that we're using for all these things is also causing disease. It does make sense that your body's using it to combat a problem in the body, which is what I believe is going on. And so the real cause of atherosclerosis is inflammation and oxidative stress that's damaging the artery, damaging the lining of the artery. And that can be from all kinds of things. It can be from our toxic environment, a poor diet. It can be from psychological stress. There's only so many different things that can cause that damage, but that damage is almost normal wear and tear in the body. Like it's almost like the body prepared for it. And that's why the endothelial cells are so good at repairing themselves if we're insulin sensitive, because insulin is what signals those cells for growth and repair. And so if we become insulin resistant and we start to get that damage from oxidative stress and inflammation, and we can't repair it, the cells, then the body's forced to do something else. And in that case, it takes cholesterol and minerals and various things and almost uses it like spackle to patch up that artery, because if it doesn't, it's going to rupture. And that's an even bigger problem than atherosclerosis short term. And so that's what's happening. And so when we look at, is sometimes we see these studies that say that yes, higher cholesterol is associated with atherosclerosis, or damaged cholesterol, like oxidized LDL or LP little A, or, small dense particles, when you look at the particle size and things like that, like those are associated with heart disease and atherosclerosis. But that's because the things that are damaging those cholesterol molecules are also damaging the lining of the artery. And so it's not that these oxidized LDL particles are these evil little things that are just going in there and damaging the artery and getting deposited there. It's that the things that damage them are also damaging the artery. And if we're in a state of insulin resistance, that can result in this plaque buildup and hardening of the arteries. And so we blamed cholesterol when really we need to be paying attention to metabolic health and oxidative stress and markers of those kinds of things. And then I also believe heart rate variability, which is another topic. Yeah.
Can you just explain to people, obviously I understand these mechanisms, but just kind of like in a easy to understand format, like how does insulin resistance cause oxidative stress where the LDL can get oxidized? Like, what does that mean? Can you explain it like at a really
level? Again, it's all about growth and repair. Like insulin is this hormone that tells your body to repair itself. And so things are going to become damaged. It's just going to happen. Like, especially in the modern world, like we're more stressed out. We're more exposed to toxins. Like damage is going to happen. And we need really intact mechanisms that tell, especially the endothelial cells to, you know, go ahead and repair themselves, replenish themselves or grow, right? We want to make new cells, right? Which is something interesting that the heart, you know, the heart tissue itself doesn't make new cells. So those are the cells you have. Right. But in the endothelia, they're really good at growing. But they need signaling. Okay. So if your insulin receptor is not healthy, which cholesterol is vital for, because one of the steps of making cholesterol is a molecule called dolichol, and that's essential for the insulin receptor to function. So if we don't have enough cholesterol, so if we're not eating enough or taking a statin drug that's inhibiting the production of it, then we're more likely to become insulin resistant. And the studies suggest that. But then that receptor may not be working, and then the insulin just floats by. And the receptor never picks it up. The cell never gets the signal to say, okay, I've been damaged. I need to repair myself. I need to take in nutrients to repair myself. Or I just need to call it quits, divide, make a new cell. And this other cell will die off, you know, and just replace it with this new cell. And if that doesn't happen, then we just get this damage that's happening in the lining of the artery. And if it gets damaged enough, it will rupture, it will break. And I think that has a lot to do with, you know, strokes and things like that. We get those ruptures, especially with vegetable oils, because vegetable oils make the red blood cells very, very rigid, which when they're trying to squeeze through a capillary is not a good thing, because especially if the capillary is already inflamed and damaged, like we're talking about, it's not getting repaired, then a rigid red blood cell is not a good recipe for those, that situation. And that's a big cause of strokes. But yeah, so we need that repair so that it can line the artery. And then the other thing I like to talk about a lot is fourth phase water. Are you familiar with Dr. Jerrold Pollack and fourth phase water and energized water?
Very vaguely.
Yeah. So just briefly, water has the ability to hold energy. It's one of these unique liquids that can do that. Energy, this is energy from the sun, from the earth, like the right type of radiant energy. And when it does, when it gets next to a hydrophilic surface, like the lining of an artery, it will structure itself into this gel-like state. So it's not solid, not liquid. It's the fourth phase of water, kind of like, think like jello. And it turns out that this does indeed form on the lining of the artery. And not only does it propel blood flow, but it also serves as a protective layer, because fourth phase water has a few names. It's called fourth phase water. It's called structured water. It's called exclusion zone water. Because the way that it forms, which if we want to get into the chemistry, we can, but the way that it forms, it excludes everything that's not it, aside from very small hydrated ions. And so things like an LDL molecule or a bacteria or a red blood cell or an HDL molecule, which is the smallest of the lipoproteins, there's no way it's going to even touch the lining of the artery if this fourth phase water is intact and it's healthy. And so the natural question is, how do we build fourth phase water? How do we make sure the lining of the artery is protected by that fourth phase water? And again, it's about energizing the water in your body by getting radiant energy into the system. Because I talk a lot about, or I guess there's in the health space, we talk a lot about biochemistry because of supplements and medications and nutrition and things like that. But there's a physics side to our body that's very, very important. And so this is why when you look at the research on infrared sauna, because infrared light is the most absorbed by water, then it's just phenomenal for heart disease. It's phenomenal for the health of the artery. It's phenomenal for people with heart failure. I don't understand why it's not more utilized, but it's because
I love my light.
Yeah, it's because it's energizing the water, not just in the blood, because the blood is about half water, but also in the cells. But specifically in the blood, it structures the water and protects the artery. It's really interesting to think about that, because it's not just about this cholesterol and inflammation and things like that. But if we treat our body, put our body in the right environment, then it knows what to do. It'll do it, and it'll protect the artery itself.
Incredible. So I heard you mention earlier about the heart. You're like, it doesn't pump, it contracts. So talk to us about why, and I've seen some of your social media posts on this, but why pumping blood isn't the role of the heart. I mean, I think if we took a survey out on the street, I think people would say, yeah, the heart just pumps blood throughout your body.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, I was taught in school, you know, that's just the way that it is. And, but yeah, I mean, the perfect question for right now, because I just talked about the fourth phase water lining the artery. And it turns out, and this has been proven in the lab of Gerald Pollack and University of Washington, they've shown that that this fourth phase water does form in the lining of the arteries, and it actually creates an energy gradient because of the way that it forms. The fourth phase water is a very electronegative space, and the lumen of what's left in the artery in the blood is a very positive space, and that creates this energy gradient that drives blood flow. And so they've done this experiments where, sorry for the animal lovers, but they euthanized a chick embryo, and they stopped the heart from beating, and the blood continued to flow as long as they put radiant energy into the system on its own. No pumping heart or anything like that. And so when you think about it, you know, there was a lot of early scientists that looked into, you know, the heart and circulation, and they found that they couldn't really fathom how a heart the size that we have could pump blood throughout the entire body. It just didn't make sense to them. It wasn't enough force. It wasn't enough energy. And if you think about it, you know, logically, if I was going to pump blood or liquid of any kind from my feet up to my heart, where would I put the pump? I'd put it down on my feet to pump it up. You know, I wouldn't put it up here in the middle and then pump down and then come back up. Right. And there is, you know,
veins are passive. So really, like, to come back up, it's,
yeah,
like, just through skeletal muscle contraction, and, you know, like,
right. Yeah. You were saying, like, we're told, yeah, skeletal muscle contraction and the little one way valves and the veins and things like that. But this fourth phase water is also there creating this energy gradient in the veins and the arteries that's promoting blood flow. And so then, you know, so the heart is contracting and it is doing a little bit of pumping, but no more than enough to just kind of move the blood through the heart itself. Maybe through some of the main arteries. But when we're talking about, you know, the arterioles and the capillaries and, you know, the place where the nutrients are absorbed, like that's gotta be something else, because the heart is there's no way it's strong enough to get that blood moving through there and get that nutrient exchange happening. And so, the heart, so if it's not a pump, the natural question is, what is it? Why is it there? And so based on what I've looked at it, and so people have these ideas like Rudolf Steiner and some of the early scientists, you know, kind of compared it to a hydraulic ram, which I didn't know what that was when I heard the term. I had to go look it up on YouTube and watch videos and see what a hydraulic ram was.
Thank you.
Yeah, right. And but basically a hydraulic ram is a flow activated device that, you know, as long as fluid is flowing into it, it kind of redirects it and it can kind of quote unquote sort of pump it somewhere else. But it's all based on physics and pressure changes. And when you look at the heart, it's actually two hydraulic rams put together, or it acts more like two hydraulic rams put together. And so these hydraulic rams are, and if you look at the way the heart muscle is oriented, it's in this spiral like nature, you know, and the heart is really one big band of muscle that's all wrapped up on itself. And so when it contracts in like this spiraling thing, it's twisting, right? Which is what's, you know, it's kind of shaped like a football. So it twists, it spirals like a football. Whereas with the problem with heart failure, cardiomyopathy is, you know, it expands, looks more like a basketball and it doesn't spiral anymore, which is a huge issue. And so one of the main reasons that it has that is because one of the other ways that you can energize water is vortexing it or spiraling it or swishing it in the presence of oxygen. And there's always oxygen present in the blood, even in the venous blood. It's less oxygen, but it's still oxygen there. And when the heart contracts and when it flows through the valves and all these things, it's just swishing the blood around. It's spiraling it, and that's energizing the blood. So then when it gets next to the arteries in the periphery, it can form that fourth phase water, and that promotes blood flow out in, especially in the capillaries and things like that. So I guess you could say that the heart is responsible for the movement of blood in a way, because it's helping vortex, but it can't really do it on its own. And if it's forced to do it on its own, energize all the water all the time, I think that is one thing that can lead to heart failure. And, you know, not being in that environment of sunlight and grounding and things like that. But that's one reason, that's one role of the heart, one purpose of the heart is that it vortexes blood. The other is that it maintains pressure in the system. Because if I was to go for a run or do some athletic activity right now, the tissue demand for my blood would cause all the blood to rush over to the arterial side. And if the heart wasn't there to slow that down, the venous side would collapse, and that would be a big issue. We would die. And so if you look at, there's these interesting studies I talk about in the book with endurance athletes, mainly soccer players, where they studied them and they showed that when they were working out intensely and exercising intensely, that the heart is actually slowing the flow of blood because it's trying to maintain the pressure in the two systems. So that's the reason that it's placed so, I would say, almost awkwardly, like between the two systems in this weird place. It's not like it's up somewhere just pumping to everything, you know, it's kind of in between the two sides. It's pretty fascinating. And there's lots of evidence for this, you know, lots of cited research and lots of other people who have been talking about this kind of stuff. But if we don't understand the true function of the heart, how are we supposed to understand, like, how to correct heart failure or how to, you know, prevent a heart attack or these types of things, you know? And so that's kind of what fascinates me about figuring out these kinds of things.
Yeah, it's totally fascinating. And, you know, we talked a little bit about cholesterol and cholesterol's role and how it's not just about cholesterol. And when you look at the data on heart attacks, many people have heart attacks with normal cholesterol levels. And that's been one of the arguments, you know, why are we just, you know, rabbit holing and pigeonholing, you know, with LDL? And patients bring this up too. It's incredible. In 2022, our patients have access to a lot of the same articles. I mean, some of them are behind paywalls, but I think that, you know, patients are more educated in 2022 than ever before. So how can people have heart attacks with, number one, normal cholesterol levels, but also no blockage in their arteries?
Yeah. So it's another fascinating thing I came across. So there's this scientist named Giorgio Baraldi, and he was kind of hell bent on the idea that heart attacks don't happen because of a blockage, at least all the time. You know, it can happen. That definitely can happen. So he started doing these interesting studies where he did autopsies on human hearts, like probably 10,000 in his career, probably more than that. I don't know. But what he did is he invented, have you ever been to like the Body World exhibits where they put in like the plastic casting and then they dissolve away the tissue and you have this perfect mold of the arterial system or something?
I'm actually friends with a pathologist on Instagram. We connected and he worked for them and like did, I was like mind blown.
Yeah.
Cool stuff.
Yeah. Super cool. And he pioneered, I think he was one of the ones that pioneered that technique because he was trying to get a perfect cast of the heart. Of the arterial system of the heart, the coronary arteries. And so he would do this, he would inject the latex in there and then let it dry and then dissolve away the tissue. And he found in one of the studies I talk about, in multiple studies he found this, but in one of the studies he found that everywhere that there was a 70% or more stenosis of an artery, that the body had built an extensive network of collaterals around it that fully compensated it. And so this to me, and this wasn't just in some places, it was in literally everywhere there was more than 70% stenosis, it did that. And so to me, this explains why when you look at the research on elective stent placement, like not stent placement in an emergency like a heart attack happening, but elective stent placement, that they don't prevent heart attacks, they don't prevent mortality, you know, in people, they don't help at all because the body's already created this bypass around it. It's why then when you look at the studies on bypass surgeries, they're not really helpful for preventing heart disease, heart attacks, or mortality in general. And it's because the body has kind of figured it out. And so I've had cardiologists tell me that, yeah, but if it's a fast forming stenosis, then there's no way it could form in time. Those collaterals could form in time. It could be a problem. And I was like, okay. And I looked into it and I found two studies that showed, one of them showed that these collaterals can form and fully compensate the heart with blood in 7 days. And one found that they could do it in 4 days. Like this angiogenesis was pretty rapid. Yeah. So that's one part of it. And he also found that lots of times there are people who had a heart attack, and the heart attack happened in a completely different area of the heart than where the stenosis was, you know? So it just begs the question of what does cause somebody. So now a clot can form, you know, or like you could have atherosclerosis and a soft plaque could break off and cause a clot to form. And that's a real thing. But it's not the only way we can have a heart attack. And I've had so many people, you know, reach out to me and say, yeah, I had a heart attack and there was no blockage anywhere. Like what happened, you know? And so in my book, I outline this series of events that I believe can lead to what I think are called metabolic heart attacks, where we get, you know, we get imbalance in the autonomic nervous system. So we have an imbalanced stress response, which means that we're not adapting to stress very well. And that's a big deal for the heart, because the heart and most of the organs need a balanced signal of stress and non-stress, stimulus from the autonomic nervous system. And so when that becomes imbalanced, and that could be to a lack of nitric oxide, which if we have atherosclerosis, we're not going to make as much nitric oxide, or because that nitric oxide is essential for the non-stress signal to get surveyed or into the heart cells themselves. But if we get this imbalance in the stress signal to the heart, and all of a sudden we get this stressful event that happens, we get this surge of sympathetic or stress response signaling to the heart without the balancing out of the non-stress signal. And just like if you go for a run and you start to get, that burning in your legs from the muscle, from, because your body starts to burn glycogen stores, and that's going to create lactic acid, hydrogen ions, things like that. The same kind of thing happens in the heart. If we get this surge of sympathetic activity to it, it starts to burn more glucose than it wants to. And there's plenty of evidence that shows the heart prefers fatty acids and ketones. In a non-pathologic state anyways. And so when that happens, we get more glucose utilization in the heart, that leads to increase in lactic acid, hydrogen ions, and that creates edema, swelling. It creates angina. People think that angina is all the time that it's lack of blood flow to an area because of stenosis. But in my opinion, it's an imbalanced stress signal that's leading to increased glucose utilization that's causing this lactic acid burn, right? And that's the chest pain, which is why when you people can't go to the mailbox because of angina, it's because they're walking, you know, and their heart can't handle it because they're increasing that stress signal. But anyways, it causes edema. And what happens then is that the pressure becomes too much inside the heart cells. And usually it's less. And so the blood's coming in, you know, because the pressure is more coming from our arteries. But now if we get this edema and swelling because of the lactic acid and hydrogen ions, the blood can't get in and we get tissue death. We get, you know, dysfunctions and contraction and we get tissue death. I outline, you know, evidence for how that could be and how that can happen. But it all boils down to, you know, our stress response, but also, you know, having healthy metabolism and making sure the heart has plenty of fatty acids and ketones around, but also decreasing oxidative stress and inflammation, because that kind of stuff's going to deplete nitric oxide, which is essential for that signaling getting in there. But yeah, so heart attacks can happen with no blockage whatsoever. And it has to do with this imbalance in our stress response.
Yeah. And like for anybody that's listening, that's like, oh, I don't know. I don't know if I can buy into this. I don't know the statistic off the top of my head, but there is data that, where I live in Nebraska, we participate in daylight savings time. And just the 1 hour difference in daylight savings time and circadian rhythm disruption and autonomic stress that causes, there's like a significantly increased incidence of heart attacks like the week after daylight savings time. So there's certainly multifactorial inputs into what's happening. I can't agree with you more. It's not like one day after daylight savings time, they just started laying down a bunch of plaque.
Yeah. Well, and I talk about studies in my book too, that it's not just daylight savings. It's like Mondays. There's more heart attacks on Mondays. there's more heart attacks on stressful days of the year, which unfortunately that tends to be like around the holidays and stuff, or around big sporting events when people are betting a lot, there's lots of stress. Like there's statistics that show that heart attacks are more common around those times. Yeah. And you know, that stress can be, you know, an acute stress that ruptures the plaque and causes a clot, but a lot of times it's not. It's this imbalance in the autonomic nervous system that causes this cascade of events that happens and causes this heart attack with no blockage.
Yeah, I just got back from Metabolic Health Summit and was talking to Asim Malhotra. So for anybody that doesn't know who he is, world-renowned cardiologist from the UK. And I'm going to bring him on the podcast just so you guys know. We'll bring him on and talk about it because he's got a book out about cholesterol and statins as well. But he said, I have some data that's going to blow your mind. And he said, I figured out what causes a lot of heart attacks and heart disease. And so I'm, you know, the gynecologist is waiting. But he said the treatment is meditation. And I was like, oh my gosh, like it makes sense. And it's exactly what we're talking about right now. It's exactly what we're talking about. People in this day and age don't have outlets for stress. They don't have mental resiliency, physical resiliency. It's a real, real problem. And then they turn to coping mechanisms like food, women in particular, you know, especially carbohydrate, sugar-laden processed foods, alcohol. I mean, you think of all the behaviors that we use as coping mechanisms that are just like fuel on the fire. Like we know that people that vacation have better longevity and less cardiovascular risk. Like there's very, very, very good data that like rest and recovery from these stressors in our life is so important.
Yeah. And a lot of vacations are you go to the beach and you sit in the sun, you energize the water and in your blood, you ground, you walk on the beach barefoot.
Yeah.
Like that's what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing. Talk to me about why the heart doesn't really get cancer. We hear about breast cancer and prostate cancer, the most common cancers in men and women. And then we're seeing such an increased risk of colon cancer. Why don't we hear about grandma dying of heart cancer?
Yeah. So someone posed this question to me a long time ago and I was just like, that is fascinating. So I started looking into it and, you know, kind of developed my own theories as to why. But yeah, it is like one of the rarest forms of cancer. And even if it does happen, it's even rare that the primary tumor is in the heart. Usually if it does happen, it's metastasis and it comes from somewhere else. And I think that one statistic I talk about in the book is that there's just one guy, I think in Canada, that's kind of like the closest thing we have to a cardiac oncologist. And he sees like maybe 8 cases a year or something like that of heart cancer. So it's very, very rare. And they're all sent to him. They're not like it's in his town where he works. They're all sent to him from all over the place. But yeah, so when I thought about this, so you're asking questions at the perfect time, like these perfect segues, because we just talked about like, you know, the metabolic heart attacks. And that has a lot to do with why I think the heart doesn't get cancer, because I mentioned before that the heart cells, they don't divide. So at some point in development, they lose the ability to divide and become new cells and regenerate regenerate the tissue. And so the heart cells you have are the heart cells you have for life, which is why a heart attack is a big deal, because if those cells become damaged, they can only repair themselves. They can't replace themselves. And so because of that, there's theories as to why that is. And the main one is that because the heart is such a metabolically active tissue, because it's always contracting. You know, that takes a lot of energy, and so does cell division. Cell division takes a lot of energy. And so it kind of sacrifices ability to make new cells so that it can be this constantly contracting thing, especially in mammals, because we're so metabolically active and we're so, we're moving, we're warm blooded, that kind of stuff. And so, when we look at the other interesting thing that I mentioned is that the heart prefers fatty acids and ketones, because that's a much more efficient fuel source. And if you're familiar with Thomas Seyfried and Metabolic Health Summit with Dr. D'Agostino, like, you know, that ketones are a non-fermentable fuel source. And when we get cancer, it's because the cell has converted over to fermentation, when really it likes to use oxygen to make, oxidative phosphorylation, which is using oxygen to use these fuel substrates to make energy. Instead, it starts fermenting in cancer. And so the heart prefers these ketones, and it's always going to prefer them. And that is one reason why it rarely gets cancer, because it's using this fuel source that is not fermentable. So the cells can't really convert over to that cancerous state. But the other thing is that, like I said, the heart cells don't divide. And what is the characteristic of cancer? Is that it's a rapidly dividing disease, right? Because in the short term, that's the solution to a very damaged, toxic cell. And so if a cell can't divide, so if we get this situation, so like in cancer, the mitochondria become damaged. It can't use oxygen to make energy. The cell can't. So it reverts to fermentation. And we get this acidic, rapidly dividing, undifferentiated cellular growth. If that doesn't happen in heart cells, like it just doesn't, because they prefer ketones and they can't divide. But there is a situation where it does happen, or conversion to glucose and fermentation of lactate does happen. And that's the situation I just talked about, where we get this imbalance in the autonomic nervous system. It's forced to use more glucose than it wants to. And the heart tissue is, and then we get this increase in lactic acid and hydrogen ions. However, the cells don't become cancerous. They die, which is what a heart attack is, you know, because they can't divide. They can't become cancerous cells. They just die. So that's one reason why heart cancer is so rare. The second reason has to do with fourth phase water, which we've already talked about. So fourth phase water doesn't just form itself in the lining of the arteries. You have to think that, like, if I grab the tissue of my forearm, you know, it feels like jello, right? It doesn't feel like a waterbed. You know, we're told that we're 70, 80% water, but it's not in this liquid state. Otherwise I'd be sloshing around like a waterbed. It's in this gel state. So all of our cells are filled with this fourth phase water. And so if we're thinking about, you know, so if you look at Otto Warburg's work, he talked a lot about how cancer cells lose their shape because they can't keep the water in them structured, because it takes a lot of energy to keep that water structured. Well, let me back up. Think about Jell-O. Okay, so what does it take to make Jell-O? We have to have energy, which is heat. You know, we have to have a hydrophilic surface. Like the lining of the artery is a hydrophilic surface. So the hydrophilic surface in Jell-O is the proteins, the collagen, the gelatin. And we have to have an energy source that breaks open and unfolds those proteins, so there's more of a surface area, right, for that hydrophilic surface. And so we heat it up. When we cool it down, it cools, and the protein cools in this unfolded state, and we get a gel, right? Same kind of thing needs to happen in our cells, so they maintain their structure. And so what happens in the cells, so the energy source for our cells is ATP, right? That's what unfolds the proteins in the cell, like the matrix of the cell that keeps it structured. And then the water in the cell is next to those hydrophilic surfaces. So as long as we have adequate energy, you know, electromagnetic energy, radiant energy into the system, it can stay structured. Okay. And then we also have lots of ATP, which the heart prefers fatty acids and ketones. So it makes efficient amounts of ATP. However, if those things break down, then the heart it can go more of a cancerous direction, because the cells can't divide and they just die. And so when we think about that, we also have to, if you're familiar with heart math, and the Heart Math Institute and heart rate variability and that kind of stuff.
Yeah, HRV, like one of the new vital signs.
Yeah. And so when we look at the heart, you'd think that the brain would have the most, the highest or the strongest electromagnetic signal in the body, but it's actually the heart that has the biggest electromagnetic signal. So when we talk about what energizes water in the blood, the right type of energy, like grounding on the earth and that kind of stuff, the heart actually provides its own amount of this electromagnetic energy, larger by far than any other organ in the body. And so that's what's keeping this water energized, along with the efficiency of burning fatty acids to ketones to make ATP. And so that's what keeps the proteins unfolded so that we can form structured water, so the heart cells are healthy. And so all those things, these unique characteristics of the heart, the unique metabolism, the unique electromagnetic field, are all keeping these mechanisms at play, where other tissues in the bodies may not have that advantage. And for some reason, the heart was given those advantages. And it's likely because it's pretty essential that the blood stay energized and keep moving throughout the body in various ways. So pretty fascinating things. And it kind of throws a little bit of, you know, physiology that we think we understand on its head, which is what I like to do, because there's certain things that don't quite make sense to me as far as normal physiology and what we think it is. But yeah, that's why the heart seems to be protected against cancer. In my opinion, it has metabolic and electromagnetic advantages.
Fascinating. Okay. So, I mean, all the science sounds great. It's making sense. Let's apply it to the real world. What should people be eating to protect their heart? Like, what is a heart healthy diet? Because I have a feeling what you're about to say is not what was in my textbooks and my nutrition program. It was like Mediterranean. That's all we ever heard about. So tell people what a heart healthy diet consists of.
Yeah. And I think lots of times these days there's a lot of diet dogma out there. And so I will start off by saying that the best diet for heart health is one that creates metabolic health. And there are lots of different diets that can do that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, a ketogenic diet can do that, or, you know, even a whole foods vegan diet could do that, though I don't recommend that because you're going to be deficient in nutrients long-term. But it could create metabolic health, in the short term. A paleo diet, you know, there's lots of different diets. Like, in general, a whole food diet is going to create metabolic health. And the three things that I tell people that you should avoid at all costs, no matter what the diet is vegetable oils. They tend to break the metabolism and be the driver behind insulin resistance, in my opinion. Processed grains, which I would consider almost all grains to be processed, so I don't know that we should be eating them at all, at least in large quantities. And then sugars, especially processed sugars, the high fructose corn syrups, and just the added sugars to everything. Like, those things are the things that are really driving this poor health epidemic from a dietary standpoint. And then I would also add that there are lots of nutrients specific to animal foods that are critical for heart health. One of them being saturated fat and cholesterol, but also foods like carnosine and carnitine and taurine are essential for the repair of heart tissue. Because remember, those cells don't divide. If we need to repair them, carnosine is essential for that. And carnitine is essential for transporting those fatty acids to the heart tissue, into the mitochondria, which is critical for heart tissue because it's so mitochondrial dense. And taurine is amazing for the health of the lining of the artery. So is arginine, which is another amino acid. So we find these predominantly in animal foods. So again, how could, you know, a food with all these heart healthy nutrients be causing heart disease? And then I'll just add, as far as nutrients go, I consider, you know, other things besides food nutrients to the body. So when I'm talking about sunlight and contact with the earth, like, these are nutrients too that we don't necessarily talk about because it's not something that we eat, but it's nourishing your body in a different way. Infrared light, radiant energy, like even the energy that other humans give off is compatible with us. And then you talk about energy that's not compatible with us, like, 5G or Wi-Fi or things like that, or just, you know, what electronic devices give off. We need to be conscious of that as well, because those things are not compatible. They're not compatible with nutrition for our body. But then also another nutrient I would say is your mental health. You know, how is your mental health, and how is it contributing or causing the imbalance in our autonomic nervous system and our stress response and that kind of stuff. Like, we got to think about all these things as nutrients and one big recipe for heart health. Cause right now it's so focused on cholesterol especially, but even then just diet, and heart disease is way bigger than that. It's way in health in general, not just heart disease, but it's way bigger than that.
Yeah. That was one of the resounding themes at Metabolic Health Summit this year. They had a metabolic psychiatry meeting like the day before MHS started. And it was a lot of mental health topics and how mental health is a metabolic disease. And I was like, oh my gosh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, it totally makes sense. You know, the more they would talk about it, the connection with the gut and everything we've talked about, like, all of these things are interconnected. And I just want people to like picture like this big table of dominoes, and like, you push one thing and it pushes another thing. Like, there's not like one single piece of magic. Like you have to do all these things to nurture your metabolic health.
Yeah. And you mentioned like the gut just briefly there. And I talk about in my book, how like the gut is like this, it's like this external environment inside our body. Right. Because it's supposed to be sealed off all the way through. And so it's kind of like, it's outside our body. And so if you look at the research, in looking at gut health and balance in the autonomic nervous system and the stress response, if our gut is not healthy, we're giving our body signals every single day, that we're in a stressful state. And that's contributing to this imbalance. Like your body is incorrectly thinking that it's in this life-threatening situation. Mm-hmm. And it starts to react that way to everything. Right. And so when we talk about that, like health of the gut, super important to metabolic health, but also balance in the autonomic nervous system. It's just, everything's all connected. You know, there's no such thing as like a disease being caused in one area of the body and that's it. It's always everything. We have to look at everything.
Totally. Absolutely. Okay. So, I end all of my podcasts with something called the semen analysis, and I'm going to highlight a study that is actually quoted in Dr. Hussey's book. It is from the Journal of American College of Cardiology. This came out in August of 2020, if you want to go find it. And basically, the recommendation to limit dietary saturated fatty acids has been just persistent for years, despite mounting evidence really to the contrary. And most of the recent meta-analyses and randomized trials, all the observational studies that they looked at found absolutely no beneficial effects of reducing saturated fat intake on cardiovascular disease. It didn't reduce total mortality, and instead, actually, they found a protective effect against stroke. Although they did acknowledge that saturated fatty acids can increase LDL cholesterol in most individuals, that is not due to increasing levels of what we call small dense LDL particles, but rather larger LDL particles that are much less strongly associated with cardiovascular risk. It was also very apparent in all the meta-analyses that the health effects of foods cannot be predicted by their content in any nutrient group without considering the overall macronutrient distribution. For instance, is it really the hamburger or is it the bun? They acknowledge that whole fat dairy, unprocessed meat, and dark chocolate are saturated fatty acid rich foods that have a complex matrix that are not associated with any increased risk of cardiovascular disease. And the totality of all available evidence does not support limiting intake of those types of foods. But yet our US dietary guidelines have continued to recommend that saturated fatty acid intake be less than 10% of calories to reduce our risk of heart disease. And we also have to understand that there's different types of saturated fatty acids. They all have a different biological effect, and it depends on what the food matrix and the carb content of the diet is. And that's, really one of the arguments of low-carb and ketogenic diets is, they're not studied. Like when we make nutritional recommendations and do studies, it's not studied in a ketogenic state or low carb state. And several foods, like I said, that are very rich in saturated fatty acids can definitely be part of a heart healthy diet. And there's no robust evidence that the current population, upper limits in the United States will reduce cardiovascular disease. They've hammered saturated fat, and yet the incidence of heart disease, diabetes, cancer continue to go up. And I think unless people start acknowledging, the role of metabolic health, diet, movement, stress, the way we sleep, how much sunlight we're getting, we're not going to make a dent in it. So just wanted to reinforce all the things that Dr. Stephen Hussey has talked about on today's podcast. Stephen, tell people where they can find you, where they can find your books, how they can work with you.
Yeah. My website is resourceyourhealth.com. And I have my books are on there. My blog is on there. My health coaching, is on there. I coach people in a setting, just give them health advice, about various things, about anything really. So they can find me there. I'm also on social media, Dr. Stephen Hussey on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter. So people can contact me there. My books are on Amazon and they're on the publisher's website, which is Chelsea Green. My book is not out in the UK yet. I think it comes out next month in the UK, but it is out here in the States. And but there's also Barnes & Noble and other places people can get it. But the only place, The Health Evolution, my first book, is available is on Amazon. That's how people can find me.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for sharing your wealth of knowledge with us. You guys go give Dr. Hussey a follow, check out his books, incredibly important topics that we need to continue to amplify these messages, because we are in strange times, that's for sure.
definitely.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys all for listening to the Fit and Fabulous podcast. Make sure you guys download it, leave us your reviews, share it with people. You guys really help us spread these messages all over the world. So everybody have a fabulous day.